You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Making of Andrew Cuomo by Chris Smith. One lesson Cuomo learned at HUD has heavily influenced his pandemic playbook. In January 1993, he traveled to Florida to help with the recovery from Hurricane Andrew and saw panicked drivers nearly mow down cops. Coming back on the plane, one of the senior FEMA guys said to me, "More dangerous than the disaster is the public reaction to it. You're managing the disaster, but you're managing public sentiment more, and a panicked population is more dangerous than any natural disaster. It's the reaction to the action," Cuomo tells me. I never forgot that. As Andrew Cuomo was apprenticing with Clinton in Washington, his father's political career was ebbing in Albany. Mario Cuomo had become a liberal hero and a national political star in 1984, delivering a Democratic National Convention speech that was a searing indictment of President Ronald Reagan, wrapped in soaring, poetic rhetoric. That keynote address made Mario Cuomo a leading contender for the presidential nomination in 1988 and 1992. But he ruminated on a decision so long and so publicly that he became known as Hamlet on the Hudson. Finally, in December 1991, with a plane idling on the tarmac, ready to fly him to New Hampshire in time to make the primary filing deadline, Mario Cuomo announced he would not run, helping, it turned out, clear the way for Clinton. Instead, Mario Cuomo stuck around Albany and in 1994 ran for a fourth term as governor. Andrew, in Washington, for the first time, did not play a major role in his father's campaign, and he still blames himself for Mario's loss to George Pataki, then an obscure Republican state legislator. All of which added an element of revenge to Andrew Cuomo's swaggering return to New York to run for governor against Pataki in 2002. On an upstate campaign swing, he told a group of reporters that there was one leader for 9/11. It was Rudy Giuliani. If it defined George Pataki, it defined George Pataki as not being the leader. He stood behind the leader. He held the leader's coat. He was a great assistant to the leader, but he was not a leader. The coat-holding line had come out of a focus group conducted by Cuomo's campaign. His cutting deployment of it made the contender look arrogant. Cuomo, trailing badly in the polls, dropped out before primary day. Then his personal life fell apart. Cuomo had married Carrie Kennedy, a daughter of the late Robert F. Kennedy, in 1990, in the same Washington church where President John F. Kennedy's funeral was held in 1963. Cuomo and Kennedy became the parents of three girls, but their relationship turned stormy, and they split up in 2003. Cuomo's divorce lawyer ungraciously told the New York Times that he was betrayed and saddened by his wife's conduct during their marriage. That period was the most searing experience of his life, the New York Political Insider says. After he was absolutely humiliated and brought to his knees by those experiences, Andrew decided no one will ever have the power to do that to him again. In the photos, Cuomo family values. Mario and Matilda Cuomo and their five children in 1977, with members of a little league team he founded. campaigning in Manhattan for his first abortive run for governor, 2002. Andrew's ex, Sandra Lee, Andrew and Bill and Hillary Clinton at Bill de Blasio's 2014 inauguration. Andrew, in his Albany office in 1983, after he helped his father become governor. In the makeshift hospital built by the Army Corps of Engineers at the Javits Center in March 2020. At the 2011 New York City Pride March, shortly after the passage of a bill legalizing same-sex marriage. Mario and Andrew at Andrew's birthday party in 1994. With his ex-wife, Carrie Kennedy Cuomo, and their three daughters in 2001. Cuomo set out to sell himself as newly humble. He visited nearly all 62 of New York's counties, chatting up local leaders. He also methodically lined up support from the state's most powerful labor unions, and it paid off in a landslide 2006 victory over Republican Jeanine Pirro to become the state attorney general. Cuomo and the new governor, Elliot Spitzer, quickly clashed. A Cuomo investigation concluded the Spitzer administration had tried to smear a top Republican legislator. Then, after Spitzer resigned in a prostitution scandal, Cuomo pursued ethics investigations of his replacement, David Patterson. A Patterson aide once told me that the governor felt as if Cuomo was lurking beneath the floorboards of the executive mansion, holding a saw. With the economy and state government in shambles, Patterson dropped out of the 2010 race for governor. Cuomo jumped in and clobbered a right-wing Buffalo businessman. His remarkable electoral comeback was complete. The fact that Andrew was on the balls of his ass and had to come back has only helped him in the long run, Cloris says. The Cuomo family had returned to its rightful place in Albany. The eldest son wouldn't just honor his father's work, he would surpass it. Where Mario philosophized, Andrew would operationalize. The new governor moved swiftly and effectively, delivering a balanced state budget on time for the first time in 5 years. Even more impressive was the elaborate bargain Cuomo constructed to legalize same-sex marriage. The New York Senate had an entrenched, fairly conservative Republican majority. Cuomo wheedled and cajoled and threatened and found the handful of necessary swing votes. Some of his triangulation, though, earned Cuomo the undying enmity of the state's growing progressive wing, especially for his role in helping prop up the Republican state Senate majority. It is just untrue, says Donnie Lever, the governor's communications director. It is our responsibility to work with the elected officials the governors, the voters, gave us. Cuomo unplugged a corruption probe when it outlived its political usefulness. This has been relitigated by the voters twice, Lever says. State unemployment, pre-pandemic, dropped 50% during Cuomo's tenure. He has also spent millions on economic development projects that have shown disappointing results. Lever, this criticism is overblown and lazy. Cuomo's muscular style became legendary. When Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy drew an unflattering comparison with Cuomo tax policy, Malloy's chief of staff got an angry phone call from Cuomo's second-in-command. We operate at two speeds here, get along and kill. And though there was some humor and useful flexing to that statement, there is an equal amount of truth to it. He just has that Cuomo family fatal flaw of paranoia, a Democratic operative says. Sometimes it really undercuts him. Cuomo disagrees vehemently with the notion that he is a dark, gratuitously combative man. There is no governor, there is no executive, There has been no mayor who can succeed in this position without being strong-willed. It does not work, he tells me, his voice rising. You can't be a pushover, easy-go-lucky, everybody's best friend politician, and be a successful executive. You can't be both. There has not been one in history. It wasn't FDR. It wasn't Teddy Roosevelt. It wasn't LBJ. It has never happened. It's like saying, I want to be a top-flight NFL player who isn't confrontational. It doesn't work. It can't be. You play NFL ball, it's not that you're a hostile, violent animal. You're a football player. And it's not that you like to hurt people. You're a football player. That's what you are. I'm a chief executive who has to get stuff done. It's what it takes to do the job. Strictly business. One consequential example of Cuomo's approach is his relationship with Bill de Blasio. The two men became friends in the 90s, and de Blasio has vouched for Cuomo at low points in Cuomo's political career. The dynamic changed drastically in 2013 when de Blasio was elected New York City mayor and pressed repeatedly for a millionaire's tax to pay for universal pre-kindergarten in the city schools. Cuomo arranged the funding without the tax hike, but his dispute with de Blasio was never mainly about policy differences. Andrew wasn't going to allow anyone to become a bigger Democrat than him in the state, the New York Political Insider says. De Blasio, stubborn and ideological, has certainly committed plenty of unforced errors. But the governor has fueled the turf war, whether the subject was repairing the city's crumbling subways or how to regulate topless women in Times Square. When the pandemic crisis loomed, the governor got the state legislature to pass an emergency law giving him total authority over local leaders, including de Blasio. At every turn, the governor's decisions have been based on facts and data, his spokeswoman says. But Cuomo, unlike George Pataki, after 9/11, damn sure wasn't going to hold any mayor's coat. 2 years ago, Cuomo ran for a third term as New York's governor because he loves the job and he won easily. There also didn't appear to be a viable path in the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. Joe Biden looked as if he might fill the moderate pragmatist lane, which turned out to be absolutely correct. By late February, Biden had basically locked up the nomination. Then the coronavirus swept across the United States, and by April, a poll showed Cuomo to be the country's second most popular Democrat after Barack Obama. I believe Andrew has done about as good a job as any one individual who was cast into a leadership role in a time of crisis has done in the past 100 years, says Ben Barnes, a Texas Democrat and well-connected fundraiser for the National Party. Lately, Barnes has been lobbying Biden's team to bring in Cuomo as campaign chairman. Cuomo really understands what people want and need to hear right now, says Liz Smith, who worked on Cuomo's 2018 re-election run before becoming the mastermind of Pete Buttigieg's surprisingly strong bid for the presidency. First and foremost, there's cold hard facts. What helps take his briefings to the next level is that he understands there is a very human element to this crisis. The thing that Trump's press conferences lack, in addition to coherence, is empathy. Andrew is showing a side of him that has always been there, but not necessarily in a public way, and that a lot of people really need right now. Yeah, they need an effective leader, but they also need Mr. Effing Rogers. Mario Cuomo was, in his eldest son's words, a big room speaker. Andrew Cuomo is a master of the inside game, and his bravura performances are usually delivered on the phone. Whether dealing with legislators or reporters, Cuomo asks about relatives and birthdays. He poses rhetorical questions and answers them. He strokes or threatens as necessary. He does voices. Transferring those touches to a wider audience was not a sure thing. Cuomo's voice and features are unconventional for a political TV star. His nasal honk of a Queens accent is so strong that listeners sometimes believe it to be a blue-collar affectation. At 62, deep creases frame his prominent nose. By some standards, the governors who have handled the pandemic best are Washington's Jay Inslee and California's Gavin Newsom. Yet Cuomo has become the media's favorite, only partly thanks to East Coast bias. "I love Gavin," the Democratic operative says, "but he is a character everyone has seen a gazillion times, and he is a little too Kendall. Andrew Cuomo is different, and it is working to his advantage." There is irony in Cuomo's rise to national fame by coming across as a comforting, if stern, father figure during the coronavirus crisis. In New York political circles, Cuomo is more feared than loved. He has never been monochromatic, though. His beneficent and his action figure sides have been most apparent, respectively, at funeral eulogies and civic calamities, from highway wrecks to Superstorm Sandy. The pandemic combines those hardships on a grand scale, and Cuomo's publicly compassionate side has seemed to enlarge in equal measure. "It's like Mario Cuomo is back," says John Marino, who was one of Mario's top aides, "because his soul is in Andrew again." Next photo, gearhead. Mario and Andrew inspect the family car in 1977. It is roughly 3 a.m. when Cuomo climbs out of bed after a couple of hours of sleep. He is alone. In September 2019, Cuomo split up with his partner, the former cable food show host Sandra Lee. She was an infrequent visitor to Albany during their 14 years together. Cuomo often traveled to the house they shared in Westchester. This Thursday morning in March, he wakes up in the same bedroom where his father slept for 12 years as governor. Cuomo walks out of the mansion and sits behind the wheel of his blue 1968 Pontiac GTO convertible, a car he meticulously rebuilt, and drives himself through the pre-dawn darkness to the state capitol. At his desk on the building's second floor, Cuomo drinks coffee and studies models projecting as many as 15 million infections in New York and a need for 110,000 hospital beds, double the state's current capacity. For weeks, Cuomo has been quizzing the state health commissioner and hospital executives and Anthony Fauci, among others, to gather information. What he hears each day is alarming. At this point, on March 19th, 43 New Yorkers were known to have died from COVID-19, but hospitals are reporting a flood of new cases and that they are quickly running out of supplies. Cuomo has gradually dialed down public activity, but the number of cases keeps increasing rapidly. Testing is barely available. And now pressure is building for Cuomo to issue a full stay-at-home order. San Francisco's mayor did it 3 days ago, and California is on the verge of doing it for the entire state. 2 days ago, de Blasio told New York City residents to start preparing to shelter in place. Cuomo responded by swatting away the city's jurisdiction and saying the mayor was using the wrong term, that shelter in place is properly associated with nuclear war and mass shootings. That afternoon, during a meeting with State Health Commissioner Howard Zucker, semantic and strategic differences give way to harsh necessity. "We're going to have to shut it down," Cuomo says. The governor announced his stay-at-home order the next day to take effect the night of March 22nd. The debate about whether he was already too late was raging. Dr. Tom Frieden, a former CDC director, would tell the Times, in April that shutting down a week or two earlier could have cut New York's death toll by up to 80%. Though as late as March 16th, Frieden was still openly skeptical about the merits of closing schools. Cuomo's case for his choice of timing involves the art of politics just as much as the science of epidemiology. You cannot move until people understand they have to move. You can't proclaim anything here. All I have is moral suasion. That is hard on a mass basis, he tells me. You know, it's an unsophisticated analysis. If you proclaim it is so, they will do it. No, that's not how any democracy works. There is no king, and it's especially not how New York works. If I said to you, we have to do this, California had a case. Who gives a goddamn that California had a case? California is totally the other end of the country. So until it was a reality here, why would people listen? What are you talking about? You're asking me to stay home? You're uprooting my entire life because it happened in California? So when you're dealing with an order that you have no capacity to enforce, where people could dismiss it immediately, you better be very careful. Because if they dismiss you, you are now at a place where no one's been before. Where you have a metropolitan region where people are still going to be doing what they want to do, and you have no credibility and no way to enforce the rules. And now the viral infection will spread at a higher rate. And if it spreads at the higher rate, you will make Italy look like a picnic. Those are the calibrations, the public health need and public tolerance, the acceptance to have compliance. From March 1st, after the first case in New York, it was a very thoughtful plan of how to implement close-down procedures in a way that the public would accept without panic and would comply. Because I had set the table, we did it in 19 days. Cuomo's claim to the fastest shutdown, counting from a state's first case to when it announced a stay-at-home order, may be the wrong metric. As the virus spread globally in January and February, shouldn't Cuomo have started preparing New Yorkers sooner? The only rationale in January and February was it's okay because it's only China, and it's not going to come out of China because China is doing a good job handling it, which is what everybody said. The president said, the CDC said, the WHO said, Cuomo says. On January 30th, the WHO said the outbreak constituted a public health emergency of international concern. In February, the CDC said the virus would likely spread in the U.S. In a governor's job, you don't really do a lot of extensive analysis of international possible health pandemics, but it was just in China. As soon as it came out of China and then went to California and Seattle, I'm not a public health expert, but I know people get on planes, and once it came out of China, once it was in California, you knew it was just a matter of time. How Cuomo used that time will be endlessly second-guessed. In late February, after lobbying Vice President Mike Pence, Cuomo won FDA approval to use a state lab for New York's coronavirus test. Faced with mixed messages from the feds and doctors, Cuomo initially underestimated the local hazards of the pandemic. We don't even think it's going to be as bad as it was in other countries, he said on March 2nd. 8 days later, Cuomo began to gradually tighten the valve with a series of increasingly strict orders, creating a containment area when a virus cluster was identified in New Rochelle, then banning gatherings of more than 500 people, then closing bars and restaurants, and on March 16th, shutting down schools in the city, Westchester, and on Long Island. Still, as late as March 17th, he told Errol Lewis on NY1, there's not going to be any you-must-stay-in-your-house rule. As a stay-at-home order grew more likely, Tamping down fear was a high priority for Cuomo. The week before, there had been all these rumors that New York City was shutting down. Melissa DeRosa, the governor's top aide, says, "The calls we were getting from reporters, from the public, from people in government, were coming from a place of sheer panic. What does that mean? Are they going to close the bridges?" As the governor has said over and over and over again, words matter. How do we roll this out in a way that the public will buy in? Plenty of New Yorkers disagree with the governor on individual policies. No one, however, doubts his intense commitment to governing. The same passion for the job that can sometimes lead Cuomo to overreach has also earned him a reservoir of credibility that has proven invaluable during the crisis. Cuomo's feel for when New Yorkers would be willing to comply with his orders was necessarily subjective and perfectly revealing. He has an unshakable faith in his ability to calculate how much pressure to apply and when to apply it in order to maintain control. This time, though, the governor is contending with two aggressively defiant actors, a deadly virus and a sociopathic president. Cuomo's phone calls with Trump are usually unremarkable in tone. They discuss the urgent need for hospital beds in New York or the supply chain barriers to ramping up coronavirus testing. The chat seems productive. They hang up, and then Trump tweets a potshot, telling Cuomo to do more and to stop complaining. Or the president suggests that New York is somehow stealing hospital masks, sending them out the back door. One-on-one, it's perfectly cordial with Trump, a political veteran who has dealt with both men says. Because the show isn't on. Backstage, before the lights go on, he's a different guy. Cuomo has known Trump for 30 years, and they were friendly, if not friends. In a high-profile New York guy kind of way, until 2016. So Trump's addiction to putting on a show, no matter the circumstances, is no surprise to Cuomo. Some of Trump's insults may be attempts at strategic theater. By bashing Cuomo, a blue state Democrat with a vowel at the end of his name, Trump plays to his red state base. Cuomo's gamesmanship is usually more nuanced. His blasts at Trump are often fired in the moment, typically after Trump has given the governor an opening by doing something egregious, but they are well thought out. And backstage directness is often Cuomo's best move. Andrew is smart enough to say to Trump, "Mr. President, I'm going to have to take shots at you." And Trump will say, "Well, I've got to do the same with you," a Cuomo associate says. This is a combination of real politic and street shit. For all his attempts to influence Trump quietly, Cuomo surely understands that appearing on television is the best way to truly get through to the president. He has walked a tricky line, knocking Trump one day for stalling on invoking the Defense Production Act to manufacture more ventilators, thanking him the next day for sending the USNS Comfort to supplement the city's supply of hospital beds. Cuomo has treated Trump as a fearful bully, someone who is driven crazy by not receiving praise, and who needs to be punched hard on the nose from time to time, and who will then usually run away. During the crisis, the governor is using butter and honey and guns and bricks and all the tricks in the book, especially in dealing with Trump, a Cuomo ally says. This is a guy who knows when to pull, when to push, when to praise, and knows when to hit. Cuomo has tangled with plenty of blustering politicians before. What's different this time is that he's dealing with a man who has no core values other than ego gratification, and that Trump outranks him. Cuomo has deftly pushed buttons in the federal bureaucracy, getting the Army Corps of Engineers to construct field hospitals, for instance. Yet it sometimes feels as if the governor is an old-school general trying to suppress a guerrilla insurgency. Cuomo deploys facts and legal arguments like B-52s. Trump caves on asserting total authority and instead uses his Twitter authority to foment anti-governor uprisings as if he were a sniper hiding in the trees. Cuomo has mostly tuned out the Trump noise and stuck relentlessly to the ground game of shoring up New York's hospital system and scaling up testing while feeding New Yorkers regular doses of hope and reinforcing the importance of maintaining social distancing. There's been an incredible leadership vacuum from Washington, and he has stepped in and done a terrific job, a New York political strategist says. But I think it's a little too early to call him the hero of this crisis. Cuomo has talked extensively about the disproportionate impact of the virus on black and brown New Yorkers. But he has released a fairly small number of inmates who are disproportionately black and brown. In late March, the state required nursing homes, which it regulates, to accept coronavirus-positive patients. By late April, there had been at least 3,500 deaths in long-term care facilities, nearly a quarter of New York's total. Cuomo says that if a nursing home can't adequately treat a resident, the state health department is available to arrange transfer to another facility. Some of the most pointed questioning of Cuomo has come from his most famous relative, Chris Cuomo, whose choice to become a journalist was disdained by his father, and whom Trump has mocked as Fredo, has pushed beyond jokey sibling banter when interviewing Andrew on CNN, suggesting that the governor had too little to show for a recent White House sit-down with Trump. Big Brother parried, "I don't know that your assertion is factually accurate," and said he had extracted a federal commitment to help double the number of tests in New York. As April gives way to May, COVID-19 deaths and hospitalizations are trending down in New York, but spring temperatures are rising, making it more tempting for the public to go outside and making it more likely that infections could spike again. Cuomo is also grappling with an estimated $10 billion hole in the state budget, but he is willing to look ahead slightly to a time when life returns to normal, though not the pre-pandemic normal, he believes. Oh, living through this will make people feel more vulnerable, more insecure. There will be shades of 9/11 in that regard, he says. You'll think about, where would I go if this happened again? You will think about this when you're in a crowded subway and somebody coughs and sneezes. You'll think about it when you're walking into a crowded elevator. You'll wonder when you walk into a bar and nudge your way up to the bar to buy a drink. What's in Cuomo's future? Throughout the crisis, he has made an emphatic point of painting his pleas for personal protective equipment and federal money as non-political, which is both true and canny tactical positioning in regard to Trump, for whom everything is a partisan fight. It will be harder for Cuomo to maintain that position this fall, even if the virus remains a serious problem. Anything short of full-throated Cuomo support for Biden will fuel chatter that the governor is considering his options for 2024. In the meantime, winning a fourth term would be immensely satisfying to Cuomo. I believe him when he says he won't be going to Washington, yet insisting he has no interest in any other elected or appointed office is also a way for Cuomo to beat back the demons of will he or won't he run speculation that he saw torment his father after Mario Cuomo's big national moment. He continues sketching life after the crisis. You will have a new orientation towards government. It matters. Oh, it matters in a way you never thought it mattered, Cuomo says, and you'll respect qualified, competent public officials in a way you never even thought of the occupation. Reaching a final judgment on the governor's competence in the face of a deadly pandemic will prove as complicated as the man himself. What's clear is that he has provided crucial emotional and practical leadership, reaching well beyond New York's borders. It's also clear that Andrew Cuomo, unlike Donald Trump, has core values, his family's values. After the End of the World, a new limited series based on Stephen King's novel, The Stand, about a global pandemic, was in production just as COVID-19 hit. An exclusive preview of Our Worst Nightmares by Anthony Bresnahan. Opening photo, Force for Good, Whoopi Goldberg as Mother Abigail, the 108-year-old whose followers hold fast to their humanity. Stephen King didn't call his novel The Virus. He didn't call it The Disease or The End of the World as We Know It or anything that nihilistic. He wanted his 1978 book about a global pandemic that takes all but a fraction of human life with it to be called The Stand. When there are no rules, his thinking went, survivors have to make a choice. Do you go full Darwin and indulge dark, selfish instincts, or do what's right for the sake of others? I wanted to write about bravery, says King. At some point, people do have to make a stand. The novel remains one of the author's greatest achievements, and a new limited series adaptation, the first since 1994, is headed to CBS All Access later this year in the shadow of an actual global pandemic. Showrunners Benjamin Cavell and Taylor Elmore, who first worked together on Justified, are quick to point out that King layered in reassuring themes along with the terrifying ones. It's about the fundamental questions of what society owes the individual and what we owe to each other, says Cavell. It's hard to know what our world will feel like when The Stand begins its 9-episode run, but the coronavirus pandemic has only intensified interest in movies like Contagion and Outbreak. The show had to wrap production 4 days early in March when COVID-19 began to shut America down, but as of this writing, the plan is to proceed with the release as scheduled. It was very surreal, obviously, to start to realize that there was a creeping pandemic the way there was at the beginning of our show, Cavell says. Next photo, Angels and Devils. Alexander Skarsgård as demonic Randall Flagg. And Odessa Young as expectant mother Franny Goldsmith. Despite parallels that fans have drawn, The Disease in The Stand is catastrophically worse than anything we've seen in real life, killing more than 99% of the population. Survivors who are drawn to decency unite around Mother Abigail, played by Whoopi Goldberg, who, over the course of her 108 years, has endured the worst the world has to offer and kept her strength and empathy intact. Her sinister counterpart is a charismatic rockabilly demon named Randall Flagg, Alexander Skarsgård. In the ashes of the old world, the new tribes head for a clash that could fulfill the prophecy of Armageddon. First, there's chaos, and then there's reintegration, says King. So it's a question of, do things reintegrate in a way that's good, or do they reintegrate in a way that's Hitlerian and bad? It could go either way, so I wanted to write about that. I wanted to put those two forces in conflict. Among the vast cast of characters is Franny Goldsmith, Odessa Young, who discovers she is pregnant just as the disease takes hold. She is immune to the virus, but will her child be too? Franny carries the literal answer to whether life will go on. We do focus very much on that story of Fran and the baby, says Elmore. What are a modern woman's motivations in this position? A 20-year-old kid who is pregnant when the world ends. She's a formidable force in this story. Over his long career, King has made us confront some horrific imaginings. But for every shape-shifting killer clown or crazed father in a desolate hotel, he has also modeled optimism and decency. King wrote the final episode of the series himself, adding a coda to his original story that offers hope for some key characters. Over the last however many years, we have sort of taken for granted the structure of democracy, says Cavell. Now, so much of that is being ripped down to the studs. It's interesting to see a story about people who are rebuilding it from the ground up. Here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Carol Burnett, on movie nights, spoiled pets, and her comedy legacy. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being at home, watching a good movie with my husband, dining out with good friends. What is your greatest fear? Fear. Which living person do you most admire? Both Obamas. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Bigotry. Narcissism. What is your greatest extravagance? My Toto toilet. What is your favorite journey? Coming home. On what occasion do you lie? When it might hurt someone to tell the truth. Which living person do you most despise? The one who thinks only of himself. Fill in the blank. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I'm so glad we had this time together. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband. Which talent will you most like to have? To play a mean piano. Also to tap dance like Eleanor Powell. For those who are too young, check her out on YouTube. What is your current state of mind? Acceptance. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My tendency to worry about the future if there's nothing you can do about it. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Career-wise, it would be being the first woman allowed to host a comedy variety show. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Person, a good novelist. Thing, a palm tree in Hawaii. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? My spoiled cat. What is your most treasured possession? My late daughter's cross necklace. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Hopelessness. Where would you like to live? Right where I am. What is your favorite occupation? Making people laugh. What is your most marked characteristic? Optimism. What is the quality you most like in a man? A sense of humor and kindness. What is the quality you most like in a woman? A sense of humor and kindness. What do you most value in your friends? A sense of humor and kindness. Who are your favorite writers? John Steinbeck, Joan Didion, Stephen Sondheim, and lately Randy Rainbow. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Atticus Finch. Who are your heroes in real life? First responders, caregivers. What are your favorite names? Carrie, Jody, Aaron, Kate, Zoe, Jack, Charlie. What is it that you most dislike? Egotism and rudeness. How would you like to die? In my sleep. What is your motto? To be untouched by success and untroubled by failure. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Carol Burnett. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part A is also available as a podcast. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times, and is also available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman. For more information and schedules, access to podcasts and other news, visit us on the World Wide Web at www.ncreadingservice.org. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with questions or comments. And thank you for listening.